How come you're not here?
Yeah, exactly.
It's all, why are you gonna get that?
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
It's possible, actually, but I don't know when.
I think we'll get started. It's that time. Hello. Oh, thank you. Wow. I don't have the ability to do that. Good to see you all. I think we will get started. There's inevitably more that I want to talk about, no matter what class I'm in charge of. And, you know, those of you who were here yesterday, we went 10 minutes over, or maybe that was Monday. So trying to make the most of our time. We'll get done what we can. And we will not worry about what we do not quite get to, right? We're just sort of starting our thought processes about things. So we've been talking in my sections the last couple of days about race categories. And one of the things I talked about on Monday in my class on whiteness is the idea of the unmarked subject. And the unmarked subject is a term that we use in social science and the analyses of power to talk about the category within a power structure that is the one that's kind of the fallback position for universal. And then other categories are marked subjects to specify something else or other. And we talked about the example of talking about great American writers, or talking about Willa Cather being one of the greatest female American authors, right? Or to be a good woman writer, to be a wonderful African American poet, as opposed to T.S. Eliot being a wonderful poet. We don't go around saying he's a wonderful white poet. We just don't. And so along a lot of different power axes, there is this unmarked subject versus the marked subject. Class is one of them, where white is the default, and any other ethnic category is a marked subject to differentiate. Men are the unmarked subject of gender, and then women become kind of the marked subject. After that class, I was remembering the fact that for most of the 20th century, medical studies, when they're trying out drugs or they're trying out, you know, trying to find the effects of certain things on human subjects, for many years, tests were done on male subjects to come to conclusions about what X drug does to people, and not done on women, because the idea was that women's bodies and chemical structures and such are more complex and weirder, like because of people's monthly cycles or something like that. And so somehow there's an idea that the male anatomy is the normal anatomy, and that women's anatomy is something else or other. So let's find out how the drugs affect men. We'll gather all our data, because the data we get when we test these on women just makes the results go haywire. And that's a very curious assumption, I think, right? When we think about that, you just think, how on earth do we conclude that this, you know, we're pretty 50-50 globally, and always kind of have been, right? But to have a normal be this one, and this be the less often studied and sort of considered the problem category, we see that in these cases of the unmarked subject, there is a power differential kind of worked into it. And when you talk about the marked category, there is this connotation of lesser or not quite normal or not the universal. I think one of the sort of most talked about undiscussed subject in our culture might be money. A lot of people find it very uncomfortable to talk about money. We know that we live in this capitalist culture where a lot of people are making a lot of money, but especially in the last couple of years, a lot of us have been pretty clear about the fact that a lot of people aren't making much. In any political cycle, you'll notice in the newspapers and in the rhetoric of political debates and polling and such, that usually politicians are on the side of the middle class, right? You know, we're concerned about middle class values, and somehow the middle class is the one we're concerned about. And, you know, most of us don't think of ourselves as being upper class. There's no actual number that we have all agreed upon that marks the boundary between middle class and upper class, right? We just think that people who are way wealthier than us are over in the upper class, and we're all kind of situated in the middle. And I don't think that there are very many people, no matter how little money they make or have, who like to think of themselves as lower class. Right? That's awkward. You know?
Poor.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, there's not necessarily a numeric distinction for what is the difference between middle class or poor. What's the lower middle class or what's the lower upper class or... You know, we live in a strange money-based class system rather than, you know, the British, for example, have had for a long time a landed class. So they differentiate between who makes money because of real estate and owning land in the family forever versus those who make money through business and are able to climb a financial ladder due to their own ingenuity or access to jobs as opposed to land and blood, right? As having been brought up Christian, I think a lot about the mandates about money that are in the Bible. There are over 1,000 verses against how we are prioritizing. And we come to a place like Holden, and Holden sort of reminds us or encourages us to be thinking about those who have perhaps less than we do. And, you know, there are an awful lot of those people. An awful lot of those people. To be at Holden at all is a marker of class privilege. Even if all of us might feel, oh, I don't have a ton, I don't have much, I'm not quite sure whether I'm in that middle class category, the lower middle class, or quite where I am, or I've been an eternal student, so I've been eating ramen for 10 years, and how wealthy can that mean that I am? But if you're at Holden, you have some privilege of time, and you have some privilege of money in order to get here. And there are a lot of people whose lives do not allow them any leisure time. A lot of people who work 2 and 3 jobs during the weekday and on the weekends in order to make ends meet. There wouldn't be any way to take a week off to not have that income, because working, you know, 70 hours or between a couple with kids, you know, both people working enormous amounts of time, you can't not work for a day and make ends meet. So we can be aware of certain kinds of privileges that we have, and I want to spend a little time talking about markers of privilege in the way that we've been kind of talking about markers of racial classes, etc. And then I'm going to read to you a few vignettes. I'm going to invite you to write a little bit and to share a little bit about the homes you grew up in will be the topic that we write a little bit about. And that's kind of what I have planned for the rest of our time. Before I read the vignette that I'd like to share with you, I want to read a couple of items from a list. There's a program of the Women's Theological Center in Boston called Class Act, and they have put together a list of the invisibility of upper class privilege. And again, there's this sense of, you know, we don't really talk about it, you know, we don't necessarily spend all our time thinking about the specificity of what we can do versus what we can't. It's easy for any of us to think about what we can't do, right? Can't go on African safari, right? That's crystal clear. But often it takes a little something, a decision and an intentionality to think about the real facts of lived lives of people who have fewer means than we do. There's some things on this list, because this is upper class privilege rather than middle class privilege, that we might not all feel, but I just thought I'd read a couple of items. I have the freedom to waste. You know, I think all of us do. Holden tries not to. Holden tries to raise our attention to the problem of waste and how easy it is to waste. But you know you're in a less privileged position when you just do not because you cannot, right? You use every bit of everything you've got. Whether it's a scrap of fabric or a scrap of food, you're not tossing things, right? You have the, I can buy things when they break. I can afford to replace the things that break. That's a privilege, right? This disposable kind of society we live in. I can buy things for my comfort or luxury rather than just the need. Right? I don't need Patagonia. I need something warm from time to time, but I don't need the brand that costs like 90 times, you know, the same piece of fleece that is being made by a number of different kinds of brands. It's a little bit crazy. Here's one. I can live where I choose and can move when and where I choose. Yeah, we might think, well, I'd like to be in a cul-de-sac, or I'd like to live next to a neighborhood with an even stronger school or something. But to have any ability to make a choice over where one lives is already a privilege. In our whiteness museum, how many of you were building our whiteness museum interiors? Ah, yeah, several of you. You remember that one of the first things that somebody mentioned was a for sale sign as an object that might go into a whiteness museum because it signifies ownership. You know, rather than borrowed, rather than, you know, I'm living in a rental so I can be booted any old time, you know, to have a for sale sign. You know, maybe that's a little bit different in the last 2 years, right? There are a lot of people with for sale signs in the windows of their homes right now, and it's not exactly that they're in some privileged position. But it's something to think about, you know, who is able to own a house rather than who's just going to rent one, and where are they going to be able to rent, you know? I remember thinking when I graduated from college and I didn't have parents who were giving me money to live on. I had about four ridiculous part-time jobs, so I felt poor, right? But when I was looking for a place to rent, I could rent a place in what was a safe neighborhood. You know, I could rent a place in a neighborhood that was filled with people who mostly looked like me. And that right there, you know, I had a college education, and the stupid part-time jobs I had paid me enough to be in a decent neighborhood rather than some place where I might have been frightened to get out of my car and walk to my door every night. You know, people don't live in those kinds of neighborhoods because they love it, right? I bet almost everyone who lives in such neighborhoods wishes they weren't necessarily there. But some of us can choose to avoid certain places and certain situations. Or certain places that we even just make an assumption about whether or not it's true. You know, there are probably neighborhoods that I could have lived in and been perfectly safe, but I maybe wouldn't have risked it because I made some assumptions about what people looked like who were living in that neighborhood. When I moved to California and got my job and was looking for a house to buy, there are all kinds of Latino communities in my area. It's not necessarily a majority, But the Latino community is largely staunchly Catholic. And as a gay person showing up in these neighborhoods, I remember looking at some townhouses, they were in my price range or whatever. And, you know, I was feeling like, oh, it would seem lovely in a way to live here, you know. I don't have anything against the Latinos, you know. They are other than I am in a certain kind of way. But as a white person coming from a place of privilege, I feel as though I can benevolently agree that they are good. I'm going to make a judgment that they are lovely people. So absurd. But I did feel a little bit uncomfortable about my identity in terms of the strong Catholicism. I thought they might not welcome me. And if I buy here and then can't leave, it might become some uncomfortable situation at some point. But again, I had choices. I could choose to find the spot where I fit in. And a lot of people don't have the means. A lot of people just end up sort of getting a room with somebody they happen to know. Sort of getting a foot in the door via a very crowded house where they're contributing something or not, but not necessarily able to get their own place. So to have a place of your own, you know, to not share walls with somebody else. I couldn't afford a place where I didn't share walls with anybody else, California. and that was fine by me. I've lived in apartments all of my adult life, and I kind of like the community atmosphere of being close to my neighbors, rather than just being out in the boonies of a cul-de-sac, you know, like, hello, who are you people? on that note, there's one other item on this list. I can hide family secrets and family failures behind the doors of my home. That's an interesting one to think about, as being a privilege of a certain economic class. Maybe you think, well, certain disasters you can't hide from anybody. But if you're living in shared walls, in shared space, etc., sometimes you cannot keep those secrets because you cannot afford the degree of privacy that would allow you to do so. So that's a strange one. You know, we don't want to be thinking to ourselves, I have secrets, and ha-ha, lucky me, I can hide them. You know, that feels kind of awkward, but it nevertheless is a privilege. I think that's all I just want to say about that. And I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk about a book I mentioned before. I read a few excerpts from it. Yes, please.
One of the things you're talking about, and one of the things that someone has told me, which really kind of corroborates what you're saying, is there's really only one thing that money can buy. The only thing that money can buy are options. And that's exactly what you just said. Okay? If you've got money, you've got options. You've got the option to choose the clothes. You've got the option to, even the one you said, you've got the option to waste. So the only thing that money buys is options.
The freedom. Freedom.
Yeah.
That's another way to say it.
Well, I was going to mention one other little set of these.
It's a little bit on the slippery side, however. Framed that way, at a certain point due to, for instance, regulations around tax and also what you do with that, you end up with less freedom.
Well, yeah, but you can opt to...
That's true.
You can choose your work, in a way. You have an option for how big a salary you...
Right. Well, the way I was using freedom is freedom to choose.
Yeah. Interesting. In my work, one of my specialist fields in English is British literature of the 19th century. And a couple of the seminal texts that I teach in my British literature survey about that have to do with the rapidly industrializing culture of 19th century. And there is a book called The Great Towns that was written by Friedrich Engels, who was the co-author with Karl Marx of Das Kapital. And Engels wrote The Great Towns. He was a German. He had gone to England and spent a ton of time in London kind of as a naturalist observer. He was going around to neighborhoods where the people who worked in factories were living. And, you know, in the mid-19th century, before there was much regulation on the hiring, you know, we can think of the era of child miners, you know, 5 years old, working 20 hours a week or something, because there weren't government restrictions. There's a laissez-faire attitude about business for a very long time. And it was only a number of people through the middle of the century, many of them from Christian social work organizations, who were trying to address this issue, trying to protect children, protect the laboring poor from completely manipulative practices, you know, just unethical business practices where the only question was lining your pockets, and it didn't matter whether or not your workers were making a living wage. Because nobody was going to oversee and tell you that that was not something you could do. But Engels toured around these neighborhoods and wrote a strong piece on behalf of the social breakdown that was happening because of an economic division. And he noted that as London was growing, people in white-collar jobs were moving into suburbs that were being built really fast. You know, this has echoes to our own century, of course. Suburbs were growing, the white-collar workers were moving out into the suburbs, and then all of the money for road construction was being put into roads that would go around the slums or over the slums, or there would be walls built around the slums, so that the people with the white-collar jobs could get into their jobs in the city without having to see the houses, the living conditions, the completely impossible unsanitary conditions. There's no plumbing. There were often 20 people living in an 8x8 sort of building. And, you know, there are these booming slum areas. But because of money, a group of people could blind themselves with construction, so they didn't have to notice. Just didn't want to see the poor people who were whose lives were being so rubbed out by you know, the money the other people were making, right? Woohoo! So this too is a freedom. If you have a certain amount of money, you will have the freedom to be unaware of the living conditions of others. Yeah. You will have the freedom to be unaware of the working conditions of others. And you will have the freedom to be unaware of the financial hardships of others. A certain amount of money will grant you those freedoms. You can intentionally find out information about that and make yourself get in the middle of that data set and make different decisions, right? But again, it's a choice. You don't just have to find yourself living in that slum because you don't have a choice. You can, if you want, just buy more boats or buy more books or go on a longer vacation or something and not really worry yourselves about the real concrete lived conditions of people who are have-nots. One of the things I love about this book, The House on Mango Street, I mentioned it before. The author is Sandra Cisneros, so I'll just write that up here in big letters, C-I-S-N-E-R-O-S. This has been around for a couple of decades. It's been widely read, widely taught in high schools and in colleges. It's very accessible reading, it's very brief little vignettes. It's not the kind of... It's no Victorian novel, I'll tell you that. It's hard to get a college student to read a Victorian novel these days. But as you can see, you know, some of these vignettes are just, you know, half a page. They're just these little brief moments or snapshots. They're very poetic, and I mentioned yesterday when I read from some of these, the perspective is, the speaker is a young girl who lives in a Latino neighborhood in part of Chicago, It's a fictionalized character, but it has some things in common with the author's life. I guess one of the things I'm going to say about the book as a whole, because I can't teach you the book as a whole, you won't be here for the next 2 weeks, but one of the lovely things about this book is that the main character is interested in writing. This little girl is interested. She's an observer. She notices all the families who live in her neighborhood, and she notices some of the differences between the adolescent boys and the adolescent girls when they have a few more freedoms and she has a few fewer as she gains a certain age. She notices the homeless guys who hang out on the corner. You know, she pays attention. And a lot of what she notices is people stuck in circumstances, people who don't have many options, people who don't have choices, people who want to, people who are striving to be in a different neighborhood, but for the moment are in this one where she is, and she talks about this with her own family too. She ends up investing in her writing. She decides that her goal, the house she wants, is a house where she can invite all the have-nots of the neighborhood. And they can just come and stay, they can have some of their needs met, they can leave again, and she's going to sort of be she's not going to be wealthy, but she just wants a house that's a space for these people to come. And she talks about a responsibility to one's community that she feels, even if her writing and her desire to get a better and better education, she wants her writing to take her somewhere, she wants her writing to be a little bit of a ticket out of this neighborhood, but she ends up thinking, if I get this ticket out of the neighborhood, I'm going to come back and I'm going to get this house I'm dreaming of, because I have a responsibility. Any of us who get away from the constrictions and the lack of freedom, there's a certain, she argues, ethical responsibility to return and help others to get some options and make their way out. So the movement of her tale is a very positive one. It's, you know, difficult circumstances. I chose it in part because she lives in a neighborhood that's maybe of a kind that some of us get to drive around if we don't want to drive through this kind of neighborhood. But the person we meet in this young girl is so familiar, I think. She has the same aspirations and the same interesting personality that any of us might have. And so it helps us see this kind of neighborhood that's maybe invisible a little bit to some of us, but we see it with her sharp eyes, paying attention to concrete details. So I'm going to read a little bit. And as I read, think about the visuals that come to your mind. She's sort of, I'd call her a painterly writer. She uses details really well and sort of brings us right into a situation. And what I'm going to give you a few minutes to write about when I'm done reading is your own childhood home, or one of them, if you had more than one. Some of us have had several. But I want you to think about your childhood home, or one you have a special relationship to, and bring it to your mind's eye and think about what it might look like to someone from the outside. What would someone else looking at it from new eyes notice, and what might they think of about you or guess about your family, given where your house is situated, what neighborhood it's in, the materials it's made of, size, that kind of thing. So, a little listening to a lovely writerly voice. The house on Mango Street is the title of the very first vignette, as well as being the title of the entire novella. We didn't always live on Mango Street. Before that, we lived on Loomis, on the third floor. And before that, we lived on Keeler. Before Keeler, it was Paulina. And before that, I can't remember. But what I remember most is moving a lot. Each time, it seemed there'd be one more of us. By the time we got to Mango Street, we were six. Mama, Papa, Carlos, Kiki, my sister Nenny, and me. What do you notice already? about this character in her life?
Tina.
She's the youngest.
Mm-hmm. Only one is only one sibling, and the rest might be cousins or other extended family.
Yeah, you aren't quite clear. It's a bigger family. It's youngest. Growing anyway.
Youngest?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How many of you moved a lot when you were younger? About half of you. Frequently moving around. What were a few of the reasons for moving a lot? Just a couple anecdotally. What were your reasons for your family moving a lot?
I misunderstood the question.
Oh, okay.
We moved along when we first came to this country.
Oh, okay.
Maybe here because of okay.
Uh-huh. Okay. So moving a lot, but in a different moment in your age. Yeah. Yeah.
My father did not own a farm, and so the landlords, he would work from March 1st to March 1st, and sometimes the contract wasn't renewed, and then we had to find a new landlord to try to do another year to another year, and trying each time to have a better arrangement for feeding the family and having a roof over their head that worked.
Yeah, yeah. I bet the person who owned those farms wasn't moving every year. Right? The person with the land gets to stay there. People who don't own but are working might end up itinerant.
My father was a college professor, if you happen to know any of those.
Oh, some of us move around a lot.
And he did. Now, it was always a different school. You know, I never knew exactly why. Maybe it was position, maybe it was money, but there was a lot of movement from school to school when we taught it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is sort of a gold ring in academia to get a long-term position. And if you don't have that, you're fishing every year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, so this is a family that's moving a lot. So we can guess a little bit about their means from that alone. The house on Mango Street is ours, and we don't have to pay rent to anybody, or share the yard with the people downstairs, or be careful not to make too much noise, and there isn't a landlord banging on the ceiling with a broom. But even so, it's not the house we thought we'd get. We had to leave the flat on Loomis real quick. The water pipes broke and the landlord wouldn't fix them because the house was too old. We had to leave fast. We were using the washroom next door and carrying water over in empty milk gallons. That's why Mama and Papa looked for a house, and that's why we moved into the house on Mango Street, far away on the other side of town. They always told us that one day we would move into a house, a real house that would be ours for always, so we wouldn't have to move each year. And our house would have running water and pipes that worked. And inside, it would have real stairs, not hallway stairs, but stairs inside like the houses on TV. And we'd have a basement and at least three washrooms, so when we took a bath, we wouldn't have to tell everybody. Our house would be white with trees all around it, a great big yard and grass growing without a fence. This was the house Papa talked about when he held a lottery ticket. And this was the house Mama dreamed up in the stories she told us before we went to bed. But the house on Mango Street is not the way they told it at all. It's small and red, with tight steps in front and windows so small you'd think they were holding their breath. Bricks are crumbling in places, and the front door is so swollen you have to push hard to get in. There is no front yard, only four little elms the city planted on the curb. Out back is a small garage for the car we don't own yet, and a small yard that looks smaller between the two buildings on either side. There are stairs in our house, but they're ordinary hallway stairs, and the house has only one washroom. Everybody has to share a bedroom. Mama and Papa, Carlos and Kiki, me and Nenny. Once when we were living on Loomis, a nun from my school passed by and saw me playing out front. The laundromat downstairs had been boarded up because it had been robbed 2 days before, and the owner had painted on the wood, "Yes, we're open," so as not to lose business. "Where do you live?" she asked. "There," I said, pointing up to the third floor. "You live there?" in italics. "There." I had to look where she had pointed. The third floor, the paint peeling, wooden bars Papa had nailed on the windows so we wouldn't fall out. "You live there?" The way she said it made me feel like nothing. There. I lived there. I nodded. I knew then I had to have a house. A real house, one I could point to. But this isn't it. The house on Mango Street isn't it. "For the time being," Mama says. "Temporary," says Papa. But I know how those things go. It's really a lovely book. It's enjoyable in its language and it's thought-provoking in its overall message. Well, I'm so interested, you know, this is a great story to open with first-year college students. You know, you got this image of two houses, right? You've got the imagined house, and you've got the real house. And the way she describes the details are very concrete. There's no mention of abstractions like poor or wealthy or good or safe. There are just details, concrete details that are suggestive. In their description. Tight is not a word I would usually think of to describe stairs. What does it mean to you in your mind when she refers to the front steps being tight front steps?
Metal, narrow.
Close to the sidewalk. Steep.
Mm-hmm. Close to the sidewalk.
Close to the sidewalk. Yeah, there's not that much of a front yard there, so you get this little. And then one of my favorite descriptors, she refers to the windows as being so small, it seems like the house is holding its breath.
Yeah.
And it, you know, small is an abstraction. Small could be anything, you don't have anything to compare it to, but to use this figurative language to personify the house and suggest that the house is holding its breath is really evocative. Mm-hmm. It sort of sets everything about what this economic constraint is doing psychologically or emotionally or even physically to the family. You kind of feel like they're in there and they're wanting to be there, but for now they're here. So now I invite you, if you have pen and paper, to just take a few minutes. If you don't have pen and paper, maybe just go down memory lane. Picture one of the houses you feel most familiar with or most attached to, and think of a few of its concrete details. And maybe jot them down. And then think about how they register, how they would register to someone else, what they might communicate. Right? Just a little brainstorming. I think I only have two extra pens. Is someone wishing they could jot down notes?
Just a couple of pens.
Oh, a couple of pens there. Can I bring anyone a pen? I see no hands.
It has to be from your childhood?
Oh, not necessarily. Any house that you're attached to. just another minute or two. This is, of course, an exercise if you find it interesting, you can do on your own further, but. Well, let's just take a few minutes to share with one another a few details about a house that we are connected to, and you might want to say something about why you remember or think of those particular concrete details, and then if you want to say something about what you think that conveys to a person who's looking at it, saying, there? What kind of there is your set of details? Who would you like to share with us? Yes.
I lived on a farm, and we had a small house that had a back porch. The front porch was never used. It kind of faced the road. It didn't use it because this was the yard. And the porch was rather wide, but it leaned so that when we would come in after snow activities, all the water would run out. And then you'd go into a kitchen that was fairly big, and then a dining room about the same size, and a living room. And off of that was a very, very small bedroom my parents had. Then we had these tight stairs, and they turned at the top three. There were two very small bedrooms there and one larger one. And in that room was the only closet in the entire house. And it was about as wide as a doorway. And my two sisters and I shared that room. So we had running water, but we did not have an indoor plumbing at all. We went outside. But to me, that has now been remodeled. My brother lives there. It was the best place in the world because there was so much love in my house. And all the family were around, and we'd all take turns. We all lived in about three families in the same type of home and all went to each other's house all the time. And so the barn was about four times bigger than our house, and the greenery and things, because my dad was a farmer. And so those were the things that counted, the living. You went out to work or to go to school. And so I was glad when we got indoor plumbing, but and a TV. But I never thought of it as being, I never thought of being poor until I went to college. And I realized the people around me, what they wore. But I never really thought of it because I thought, I don't feel poor.
Yeah.
I just was poor, but yet
indeed.
My father would sell a pig or a cow and pay for my college tuition because I was the very first in my family to ever go to college.
Wow,
I was very honored to do that. So
it's interesting how we don't necessarily feel othered or lesser until someone else really points it out to us, right? The nun, you live there. Well, so far, that's my home with all these awesome people who I love, you know, and we're all kind of crammed in there, but, you know, when you suddenly have someone else offering you disdain, or in the instance of going to college and suddenly you're thrown up in relief against a bunch of other people.
You're talking about.
Yeah.
My sister, I was because I could wear a uniform.
When my sister went off to college, she had gotten up to having an allowance of $5 a month. And she was rooming with two people, two other young women, and they were both from suburbs in Minneapolis. And one of them, at least, I remember, had an allowance of $100 a week.
Oh, wow.
And they, you know, somehow they had gotten to sharing this information. Rebecca hadn't wanted to say, but, you know, I don't know, you're trying to make friends and people are asking, you know. And so when she said $100 a week in my sister's face, I don't know what it looked like, but I know what mine would have looked like. And then instantly the woman said, oh, no, but it's not what you think. I had to put a third into savings, a third to charity, and then a third I got to spend. Well, that makes it better. So you're going to graduate from college with a massive savings account that you're going to be able to live off the interest of. Suddenly $5 a month, which she was excited to earn for, you know, mowing our lawn and doing all the stuff that we did, you know, it's like, wow, that's, I guess that's kind of a silly amount of money, but it did seem fine at the time. I mean, I'm sure she wanted more at the time, but she wasn't thinking, oh, I've got to have 100. Mm-hmm. Interesting, yeah. Sometimes being living in close quarters creates the love and the relationships with others that makes a place meaningful. I have a few friends who bought big, I don't know, big suburban, like, I think of them as being almost empty houses because I can't imagine how you'd get furniture to fill them. But like the new construction big ones, you know, where like
big mansions.
Yes, the big mansions. You know, and one of my friends when he graduated from college was a banker right away, and they got some McMansion, a little mini McMansion for a starter couple with a banker salary, right? But it had like 4 bedrooms and like 5 bathrooms or something. And I remember going over to visit, and I was just thinking, where do you all stay? Do you ever see one another? You know, you have to have like your cell phones in different parts of the house.
Facebook
going,
works.
Hey, want to meet in the kitchen for dinner? You know, and there's something a little, that's not quite the kind of relating, you know, that makes you not care that you have one closet.
Awesome.
Anyway, thanks for sharing. A couple other examples. This is a fun part. Yeah, please.
How about the house on 70th Street? It was a little bungalow, and one of the things that I remember best is the dark red snowflake wallpaper in the dining room. And our dining room had white shelves and cupboards, and then this dark red, the dark red walls. It was very, very fashionable. But then upstairs in our bedroom, where we had white wallpaper with little blue things on it, not little Dutch girls or something, there were bunk beds, and then there was about a foot, and then there was the youth bed that my little sister slept in. And at the end of the beds was the dresser that the three of us shared. Sweaters were in the bottom drawer, and you know, I had the top drawer. All my underwear, all my clothes fit in the drawer. When I went to camp in the summer, we'd buy an extra package of underpants so that I'd have enough to last all 10 days. And maybe I didn't, I don't remember.
Rinse in the creek.
But we had a garden in the back, and we used to pick beans and sell them around the neighborhood. And we had a walk that was made with the bricks from Sheridan Road. We carried those when Sheridan Road was paved, and the bricks, and they came through and loosened up the bricks from the mortar. We carried all those bricks that made the path in our backyard and made the base of our sandbox.
Cool.
And they were carried in the red wagon.
Did you ever feel like you lived there, or did you just feel like you lived there?
That was the first house my parents owned, and it was like every other house, and you know, my friends, you know, we all had one bathroom. We had a dryer. This is in the 50s, and all the neighborhood kids would tromp down the basement, and we'd pretend that the dryer was a color TV because it had the
That's awesome.
And an ultraviolet light. So we'd all sit and watch the dryer.
Oh, it's
incredible to realize how much power we have to create other people's feelings of shame. Right? It left to our own devices. We feel like we're fine, we're making things up as we go, we find our own pleasure and our own means somehow, and it takes someone else sometimes to, you know, someone who had a giant TV came over and was like, you're watching your dryer. And then
hey,
just feeling,
those people didn't have TVs
around
that time.
Yeah. I remember my dad telling me that my grandpa had the first color TV in Duluth when he was a pastor at a church there, and I don't know which year that would have been, late 40s or something like that. And so they were, I don't know where it came from. If somebody, you know, people give stuff to pastors, which the pastor, him or herself, couldn't necessarily acquire. But yeah, there's a little span of time where he was very aware that all the kids wanted to come over to their house for that material.
Yeah. So I lived in the house that my grandfather built in 1904.
Oh.
And my grandfather gave to my mother. He had two daughters, so I was born in that house. And it was a big house, actually. But we were six children, and mom and dad. And then my parents had two foster children who lost their parents, and they were going to be sent to orphanage, so my father felt bad, so those two children lived. Then we had a servant that always spent the night there. Mm-hmm. So even though it was 20 plus rooms in that house, never thought it was a big house. And we girls had an upstairs study room, and we had shelves where we put our sarees and other things, and the boys, the two boys, had their own room. Mm-hmm. But they had one big bedroom, and that's where we all slept. Mm-hmm. All eight of us, we had our own beds and own mosquito nets and a ceiling fan. Mm-hmm. So we all slept, and we never had the sense of privacy too much. You know, six children running here and there. And it was not a big issue until I came to this country, how I realized everybody needs to have their own bedroom. And
I'm sorry, but you can find a house with eight bathrooms.
And when we were little, we had a bathroom that was at the very end of the bedrooms, and it had a fire escape kind of a thing. Steps. So the sweeper woman will come and empty the commodes. So we had outhouse for the servants. Mm. For us children and adults in the house, we had the latrine or bathroom, we called it, and the commodes that the superwoman will come twice a day and she will empty it out. And then later on in the 60s, they put in septic tank, and we had regular bathrooms like you do.
I grew up in a similar area, but I never had indoor. We never had indoor bathrooms. Mm-hmm. As a little boy, I couldn't understand why somebody would live in the same place where they go to the bathroom.
This doesn't seem right.
Yeah, they go out, and everybody asks, why is the bathroom next to their bedroom?
Until you've experienced indoor plumbing and how it works, that does seem like an obscene idea. Can I ask, were you in a neighborhood where others would just think that your house was among, in keeping with everyone else's, or
but
was
there?
There
were several big houses, but there were smaller houses too. Mm-hmm. I think people probably would think it was a big house. Mm-hmm. We had a big compound, and we had a cow shed. We had some cows, and we had bulls that took us in a bullock cart to school.
Oh, wow.
I have a brother who was deaf, so we had chicken and goats, because he was very fond of animals. Pigeons. So grew up with that. We were not in a farm, but it was like a farm.
Okay. Well, I know we're past time again. You know, I wish there was time to sort of hear everybody's stories. You know, there's some stuff to stay and some stuff to set up, but then this is a really fun part. So I hope you might talk with one another a little bit about your house, and if thinking about it from the outside, you know, or what it would look to someone pointing at it, might help you situate yourself in the social fabric or in a class fabric in a little bit more concrete way.